This is Indie Book Publishing. Indie Book Publishing is a show about new books and the authors who wrote them. It's an opportunity for prospective readers to hear directly from the writers, to hear what inspired them to write and publish, and to hear all the inside details about their books. And now, Indie Book Publishing with your host, Steve Jorgensen.
Greetings for Indie Book Publishing, Balboa Press. This is J. Douglas Barker. The title is The Me I Never Was, and our author, Francine C. Still Hicks, joins me from near Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, in the United States. Welcome, Francine, to the program.
Hi, how are you doing?
Doing well, doing well. Your book is interesting. The title, at least, is a challenge, and there is a sword on the front with a glowing blade. Share with my listeners what the title of your book, what the significance is, and how you began to get the inspiration to write this.
Well, the book itself basically says what it says. It says, you know, the me I never was. It's about the inner side, the inner person that we've covered up and labeled, you know, the society and family has labeled, and the true self is hidden behind the veil. So the me I never was is to bring that out, to say, to lift the veil. And the sword symbolizes the word. If you put the S in the front and put it behind the word, it becomes words. And through our word, we can divide, you know, the false from the true self inside. And it becomes the glowing light, you know, the truth. The light reveals where there's darkness, the light will turn the darkness out. It will reveal everything that's in that room. So that room is within our heart, within inside of us, that we must reveal. And I came about it through my whole life, you know, being called a dreamer, idealistic. You know, you're so dramatic. You're the strong one, where there's times when I wasn't. And I had to put on this facade. The dreams and visions I had as a child, I had to keep to myself, you know, starting at a young age, because when I would reveal my dreams to family, they said, oh, you're weird. So That's when I began to put the veil on. I began to cover up what was going on inside of my heart and soul.
Right.
And right, even from the day we're born, when we're slapped into the world.
That's true.
Literally slapped into the world. We learn the veil of pain. You leave the warm womb. And then you come out to this bright area and all these people. Already there's a sense of fear,
right,
that's being labeled upon that, you know, the infant being born.
Yeah, one of the first things I remember is the clock on the wall was upside down.
Very genius. That proves a point about
there
the
you are.
Was.
Sure.
A lot of people think infants come into this world not knowing. They are very, very aware, more aware than we are as adults. Like you said, I remember.
Uh-huh.
The wall being upside down. So was that a child's mind of ignorance or a child's mind of awareness? We come in with awareness.
Well, I don't know.
So we can start there.
Your book has a lot of poetry in it as well as inward reflections.
Right.
You mentioned your situation as a child being a dreamer and a person of vision. Some thought the visions were a little bit peculiar, maybe a little bit far-fetched. Any of those actually come to pass, or were they just imaginative ways to escape the surroundings you were in?
Let's put it this way. That was more my reality coming into the world. I was born that way. And we can go deeper into other topics, but we don't have the time for it. But I was born into that world. I was born into those experiences. And then later, I was brought away from that because that was taboo. You're not supposed to do that. You're weird. They would call you a little witch and strange things like that. So every experience in that book, I do not write fantasy. I write truth. And I've come to oneness with that truth inside of me. I have a twin sister, and she used to often kick me on the leg under the, you know, the dinner table.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say, listen, I had this dream today, and I had this and an experience. And she used to kick me to tell me to shut up. Because because that was my real world. And she said, you know, they're going to say, yo, local, you know, they're going to fingers around the temple, you know. And so as growing up, I always felt like an adult when I had experienced about 10, 11 months. And I was just learning how to walk because literally I can remember thinking as an adult, a woman of 30 years old, but I had this body that felt like jello and lead. And I was crying. I said, why is nobody answering me, you know? And then I'm laying here. Why is nobody coming to get me? And I remember at that time thinking as an adult in my head, I'm going to be independent one day. I used that word. I'm going to stand on my own. And I remember pulling myself up on the playpen. And I said, I'm going to make it. And that's when it felt like lead up. It was the hardest journey to make, was to pull myself up to the rails. And from that moment on, I said, I'm going to stand on my own. And it's almost symbolic, and I carry that with me for the rest of my life, to be independent and to look at children different also. I remember they were calling me this name. I was about 1 year old. And I wobbled on. That's at the point I was learning to walk, and I wobbled in the kitchen. And my aunt, my mother was standing there cooking. My aunt kept laughing. She kept calling me by this strange name. Sometimes they would call me by Francine. Sometimes they'd call me by my nickname, Porky, which I really didn't like. I wobbled in the kitchen. They're laughing. They said, come here. And they call me by the name. And I just looked at them. I was so upset because I didn't know who they were talking about. And I tried to speak with them through a telepathic way. I was trying to speak mine, too, because my mouth couldn't form words. It felt like my lips were all over my plate, all over the face. And so they kept laughing. My mother said, that's just the way she is, you know. And I remember standing there, and I stared at her, and I said, I am me, I am I. And I just stared, and they cracked up, and I ran off. So we come in with a conscious mind, the conscious person inside. But it's the physical body that hasn't developed to the mind yet. And this is what the me I never was. Go back to that child. That child is holding a key that you need to go to your next level of adulthood. And we find many people why the world the way it is today, because we have a lot of children out there running the world as an adult.
Well, that's true.
But if they can find that, yes, 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 that's another book I was going to work on. It's the fourth book, The Child Within. If we can retrieve and get that key of purity and find our true self and purpose within, release that child back into the universe and stop standing behind a child on a battlefield. And that's what life is. And if we can go and retrieve, go back and remembrance, and the me I never was, I have a chapter on remembrance. Go back, release that child, free that child, but gain the gift of purity, that key that they brought with them, that knowledge.
Now, Francine, you have 290 pages, and you say your first experience hearing the words, I love you, was at the age of 7 years old through a vision. And it left a profound imprint on you. I'm going to ask you at some point to read one of your poetry pieces and share that with our listeners when you have a moment. But in writing this 290 pages, Francine, was this a long-term process of writing, or was it something that just came together for you?
It took, well, it took 37 years.
37 years.
To write that book.
Yes.
37 years to write that book. You would think it would be 1,000 pages.
Well.
But that's why I often make the statement that quality does not come in quantity. It's what the story is about, the truth. Because it doesn't have to be have quality, quantity with it. I was 7 years old. That's just one of the experiences. I have my whole life is an experience, as we all have that. But my story is, at 7 years old, about five, springtime, and I was about to awaken. I was sleeping. I always slept in the middle because I had my older sister to the right, my twin sister to the left. They placed me in the middle because I'm 5 minutes older than my sister, my twin. So this one particular morning, it was about right before sunrise, I heard a voice call me by my nickname, Porky. it was a man's voice.
Hmm.
And I thought I was just dreaming, you know, so I just kept my head down. Then he said, it's stronger. And so I put my head up, rubbed my eyes. Here was this vivid color. Because we had nothing on the walls. They were just plain white. And I looked up, and here's this man's face. And behind him was a battle scene, bodies, the dust still coming up from after a war. And he said, it's me. And I start whimpering. I start crying. I wanted to push my sisters, you know, to wake him up, nudging to wake up, because I'm sitting up by that point. And of all mornings, I'm thinking in my head real fast, they won't wake up. They won't wake up. So he says, don't be afraid. And he said it with a sternness, but there was a love there also, a familiarity,
right,
a kindred spirit. And he says, wait, it's me. Look in my eyes. It's me. It's me. And when I sat there, and I'm saying this quickly, you know,
right,
I looked, stared into the eyes, and I knew who it was. It was someone that it felt like I knew through eternity.
Hmm.
It was a familiar soul. And he said, don't be afraid. I can't stay long. I, you know, I have to count the souls that we have lost on the battlefield.
Uh-huh.
And I started crying. And I asked him, what do you want? And we went on, you know, asked, what do you want? And he gave, want me to do? And he gave instructions and stuff. And then he says, I have to go now. They're calling me. I have to go. And I asked him, this was all telepathic.
Yes.
I wasn't moving my lips. And I asked him, I said, can I go with you? He said, you can't go where I'm going. I started to cry again. He said, I have to go. The vision faded out. And as I put my head down, I'm crying because I knew who it was. And I'm crying. I thought he was gone. I was never going to see him again. And the face fades back up to the walls, and it says, I love you.
Mm.
And then it fades back away. And I just cried myself back to sleep. And I remember thinking, because I wasn't supposed to tell anybody about this vision. And he said he promised to come back for me. And I cried myself to sleep. And I said, I can never tell nobody the word love, you know, because I really didn't understand it totally. But I know, I thought it was, you know, between adults, you know,
yeah,
this love thing.
Well, one point,
so
one piece that you did write is called A Timeless Love. And I'm going to read it since you have so many other things that are of interest to you. I waited for the call, a timeless love resounding in my soul, reverberating through every beat of my heart, resonating, I love you. A timeless love, not forgotten. A ship upon the seas of transition, I hear your call. Within the waves I hear, I haven't forgotten you. I love you. I love you. That sums up basically the kind of encounter that you are referring to.
Yes, yes, yes. And every now and then I would have, I call them vision dreams, where this soul would come in different forms within the vision dream. And then he adhered to one form. And we would go to a place, it's called the Trysting Place. I have a piece of artwork in the book that is called the Trysting Place. And he said, we would meet at this tree, and in this vision dream, we would meet and go over different experiences that we were going through in life. He was somewhere else, but yet I would sit there and just listen. You know, I would find enjoyment just to watch this movement.
Now, Francine, share with my listeners one thing, please, and that is what you hope they will achieve from reading The Me I Never Was.
I want the reader to be able to read that in an intimate way, in a romantic way of themselves, to go inside and romanticize the love that was implanted in them, to romanticize their purpose of being, to have an intimate relationship within. We can marry, we can have children and everything, but when you're off to yourself and you might be sitting in the car and you're thinking, it's just you inside with you, having that intimate relationship, to walk away stronger within themselves and lift the veil. Don't be afraid to lift that veil to find out who you are, because who you are is your sole purpose of being here.
Interesting perspective.
Interesting perspective. Yes, 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 yes. And that's why I find myself, when I'm speaking with one person, or a person may call me or come up to me, even with that person, I become one with them, because I know there's no different, that we all are seeking it. Why were we born? Why did we want to incarnate in this earth? to seek that love, to seek our beginnings, to find out, you know, who we are inside.
Interesting perspective. The title of the book, again, is The Me I Never Was. Francine C. Still Hicks has been my guest. Francine,
yes.
Where do my listeners get a copy of your book?
They can go to Balboa Press to purchase the book. At balboa.com, press.com. On the website, you can go to Amazon Books. They have it, Barnes & Noble. There's a listing online.
You have a website as well, correct?
I also have, yes, I have a website, The Me I Never Was, www.themeineverwas.com/. And I have another site set up called themindyourspirit.wordpress.com/. And another one that deals with the historical legacy of family, finding yourself. It's called The Legacy of Promise, and that's at thelegacyofpromise.webs.com/. The book is also being offered, sold on that website, too.
Fabulous. Francine, thank you for sharing your insight onto the background and how you came about publishing this book, The Me I Never Was. Thank you for joining me today.
Thank you, Jay, for having me, and I want to thank everybody else that was a part of this Balboa Press awesome group.
All right.
Just want to thank everyone for coming a family.
Thank you again for joining me. For Indie Book Publishing, Balboa Press, this is J. Douglas Parker.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages. Congratulations on being the proud owner of an adorable, soft, cuddly, sweet-smelling, smiling, cooing, hungry, tired, gassy, screaming little bundle of joy. So now what? Where's the owner's manual for this thing? Where are my instructions? Right here. It's Baby and Toddler Instructions with Blythe Lipman on toginet.com. Infant care specialist Blythe Lipman has worked with babies for over 20 years and works extensively with new parents, providing workshops, in-home visits, tips, and daily phone calls to ease those frazzled nerves. With Baby and Toddler Instructions, you can get the advice you need on how to survive and enjoy your baby's first year. For more information on Blythe and how she can help you, go to babyinstructions.com. From 32 ways to stop a baby from crying, to 14 ways to get a baby to eat, and so much more. It's Baby and Toddler Instructions with Blythe Lipman on toginet.com. Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host, Steve Jorgensen.
The title of the book, Reclaimed. And the author is Ray Cook. And Ray joins us now on Indie Book Publishing. And this interview is brought to you by Balboa Press. Hello, Ray.
Hi, Steve. Thank you for having me.
This is your true story. You're very, very candid in it. It's about a gay Mormon boy living a double life. And he discovers his personal power and reclaims his identity. So this is a long journey, isn't it?
It sure has been, but very worthwhile.
You're in a good place now. What I'm reading about, you found your self-worth and you found happiness. You've discovered it's a choice. Take us back. When did you know that you had these tendencies, these gay feelings?
So I was probably around the age of 5. Of course, at age 5, you don't know much, but I knew that I was different, and I didn't know what that meant or how to, like, put it into words. But, you know, just my school friends or my neighbor friends, they would have, like, these little girlfriends or boyfriends, and I didn't get it. But I knew I was different, and I would play house with my male neighbor friends, and I just always, liked the company of boys. And then as I grew up, I just liked the company of older men. And I've always had close friends with females, and I can relate to them and bond, and we have an emotional connection. But as far as, like, I didn't find out until later in my teen years, when my puberty kicked in and hormones, and that I was sexually attracted to males, and started having not just infatuation feelings, but falling in love feelings, And that's when I could finally pinpoint and say, it was quite a revelation to myself to actually say to myself, I'm gay. And I remember doing that. I was watching a TV show with my mom, and I kind of just said it under my breath. I think we were watching Oprah and about the topic. And it was so terrifying yet liberating. And I remember just kind of like whispering it into the pillow. And anyway.
Right. And did your parents know? Did you keep this a secret all those years?
I did. You know, later as an adult, I asked my parents if they knew or had an inkling, and they said they didn't, and they were very surprised and shocked. So I guess I did a good job of playing the role, but I wasn't forced out until I was in college, and all along I think I overcompensated because I knew I was living a double life, and so I made sure that the facade was perfect. I was the perfect Mormon boy. I knew what I needed to know. I did what I needed to do. Straight A student in athletics, and I did not want to be found out, and I guess I succeeded.
And you went on a mission for the Mormon Church.
I did. I went to Germany. My initial plan was just to escape. As soon as I got there, I was going to ditch everything and start a new life as an expatriate. And I guess it was kind of my last chance to really know for myself that religion wasn't for me. I already pretty much knew, but it was like my last ditch attempt. And on my mission, that's when I really found out for myself spiritually that you know, with my higher power, I was okay, and I didn't need to fight it or disprove it. And I also came to terms with it was time for me to be honest and the power of integrity. And I finally came clean, which got me sent home from my mission. And awaiting me was my an invitation to my church court for excommunication.
So before you got home, your parents knew?
Yes. So I got kicked out of college, and I tried to just pick up the pieces from there for a year. But I went back to the same college. Long story short, I was a competitive collegiate cheerleader, and I was the main tumbler, and they were going to compete at nationals, and I got a call from my coach. And so I went back knowing that I was going to lie through all my interviews and just kind of play their game because I really wanted to compete. That was taken away from me the last year when I got expelled after I confessed who I was and what I was doing. And my parents knew, and then so I went back for that year, competed, and then I decided to try this whole mission thing because it's kind of like a rite of passage. As a Mormon male, you're pretty much expected to go on a mission, and it's kind of fun to see where people get called, you know, which country, if they're going to learn a foreign language. And so I was curious as well, and I secretly filled out my papers. It's kind of like an application process, and I didn't let my family know that I was doing this because my plan was I wouldn't consider going unless it was to Germany. I had been there before, and I have a passion for the language, et cetera, but I was just going to call it off. But it was to Germany, the exact place that I'd been to before. And so I got excited and decided to go. And like I said earlier, I was going to use it as my escape plan. And life had better plans for me, I guess.
So when you left on your mission to Germany, everything in your parents' eyes, the church leader's eyes, all your friends, everything was on track. You were fulfilling your dream.
Yeah, I mean, as far as they were concerned, and what they knew, and what was like on the books and the list of check boxes. I was good to go. I had a worthy temple recommend, which is basically a get in your like a membership card to get into the temple. And I was covering up a lot of many years of just lies and secrets and a double life, and that came to a head when I decided that I wanted to be have some self-respect and just be proud of who I was. And I couldn't develop that by continuing to lie and betray who I really was.
Yeah, you couldn't live a lie and really be yourself, obviously.
No.
No, you couldn't do that. And how long were you on your mission before you told, I guess, your mission leader?
Yeah, so I was out about 10 months.
Okay. So what was his reaction?
He was very loving. He's a wonderful, wonderful man. We're still friends, and we just had a correspondence recently. And he wanted me to stay. I wanted to stay as well because I was in the service of other people. I had personally decided not to proselytize, not to preach anything out of my mouth because I didn't want to be a hypocrite. So I kind of did all the other things that I could do and still keep my self-integrity. And he wanted me to stay, but the powers that be in Salt Lake said that I needed to come home. And so I had an exit interview with him, and I remember one of the most profound things to come from him as my mission president, you know, a high church leader, was he just wanted me to be happy. And he said he hoped that I found a man that I could love and treated me well, and I was just blown away by that. That was very novel to me, and but very profound.
So this journey of yours, where are you at right now? I mean, I guess before you tell us where you're at right now, what were some of your more challenging things to deal with after you decided to be honest with yourself?
So the fallout from my family, from my community, friends. Growing up Mormon, even though I was entrenched in it and I was a missionary, the subject of excommunication is quite taboo. And really all they talk about is, you know, after someone's excommunicated, that, you know, they lose the Holy Spirit and they're kind of doomed for this life and eternity. And there's really no guide map of, you know, what to do with your life after excommunication. It's kind of like being shunned and like not belong, like not having anywhere to go. And so I had to figure that out pretty much on my own. My parents, I felt for them, and I was it was emotional for me to see them be so heartbroken, because I've always had a good relationship with my parents. And you know, their whole belief system, as me being excommunicated, they would lose me for eternity. So that was pretty big for them. But just the fallout for my family, you know, it's a big stigma in the Mormon community. You know, a lot of gossip and judgment, and it's one of those big taboos. So I was pretty much on my own, needing support, not knowing what kind of support that was, but just wanting, I needed my family and friends to be there for me and love me and say that everything's going to be okay and we love you anyway and you're going to be all right. But my family at the time only knew how to, they loved me the best they could, and I don't blame them. But their way of loving me was trying to get me to come back into the church, get rebaptized, and they weren't getting the fact that who I really was, and not taking that into serious account. So I dealt with that fallout, and then just kind of finding out who I was, like what I really believed in, not having the middleman, and what that meant for my life. Was I okay taking the risk of estrangement from my family and friends and community? And like, I had to forge a new identity, and who was I, and what kind of life I was going to lead. And but most importantly, I think the hardest thing for me is I had come from a place of really I hadn't developed any sense of self-worth, because I had always got that externally from, you know, when I was good in the church, from praise and validation from my leaders and my family, and like being the poster child. And shortly after, well, in my double life, when I was experimenting sexually, I got validation just through sex, like, and that made me feel wanted and important. And even though it made me feel shameful and guilty at the same time, so I had to start from scratch and figure this all out, which was pretty daunting and devastating.
You say you've gotten your happy back. So how did that happen?
Oh, my goodness. A lot of time and patience and good people in my life. You know, some friends are still in my life now who went through that whole process with me, back through the excommunication, and just a lot of nice people willing to listen and just hear me out and not try to tell me what to do or what I what they think I should do, but just give me a shoulder to cry on and an ear to hear me out and kind of figure things out. I also therapy. I owe a lot of credit to my therapist. He got me to see to really appreciate my own resilience and how I use coping mechanisms and how strong I really was when I didn't think I was, and to get me to recognize that in myself, and also to understand why I was doing things. I was doing self-destructive behaviors even though I knew better, but I didn't know why I was drawn to that. And I found out, you know, through the process of therapy, it was, you know, I had a lot of unresolved issues of self-esteem and self-worth and unfinished business with my family, and coming to terms with just being okay with who I am, and a lot of forgiveness. I had to forgive myself first, but then just not blame anyone else like I was used to, and just take a different path of, you know, what's, I learned the lessons in the past, and I have the power now to create the life that's on my own terms, a self-approved and self-loving life. And so it's been a process, and I owe credit to a lot of wonderful, loving people along the way who were gentle with me.
As we already said, this story is true. It is even graphic at times. You've gone down that road, I guess, for a reason.
Yeah. So I took out a lot of graphic stories because I didn't want it to be just kind of entertainment smut, as I think I wrote somewhere. But the things that I did keep in the story, they're there for a reason, because I wanted to give the reader a sense of, you know, where I came from, as far as my upbringing and what was instilled religiously, but then also the extremes that I went to, because I think when I betrayed myself, self-betrayal made me do a lot of extreme behaviors, because it was like a cry for help, and I wanted to, and in those extreme behaviors that I depict in the book, I also learned a lot about myself and about other people, and I wanted the reader to know that, you know, you can go from these extremes and still make it out on the other end intact, happy, you know, with a good story, but knowing that, you know, you can survive and you are resilient and you are powerful, and your past doesn't define you. It certainly doesn't define me today. It's helped me become who I am, but so I kept the stories in there for a reason that goes along with a theme, and I guess a little shock value is entertaining, so why not? But there's more to it than that.
Well, you have found yourself, you're at peace with that, and you're moving on with your life. We've been listening to Ray Cook, the author of his book, Reclaimed. Ray, tell us the best way to get your book.
Probably the most convenient way is Amazon. It's available in hardcover, paperback, and also ebook, Barnes & Noble. You can order it through balboapress.com. or my website, rclmd.com.
Thank you so much, Ray, for joining us on Indie Book Publishing.
Thank you, Stephen. Thank you to the listeners.
And this interview has been brought to you by Balboa Press.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages.
Join us for Self-Aid Success Stories with Helen Wu, Wednesday nights at 10, 9 Central on TogiNet.com. Helen Wu was born and raised in San Francisco's Chinatown, and after a very difficult upbringing, fighting depression, abuse, and addictions, she finally finds herself genuinely happy inside and out. Helen believes in taking our positive thinking and doing something positive to achieve a positive outcome. She's here to make a positive difference in your life, to be your game changer, your aha moment mentor. She's ready to help both men and women get into a better place. Helen Wu is also the author of Self-Aid Success Stories, 25 Success Stories from Successful Entrepreneurs. Inspired by Ellen DeGeneres, Helen wants the world to know that just because we find ourselves in a difficult situation doesn't mean we have to stay there. We can aid ourselves to a better life. So join us for Self-Aid Success Stories with Helen Wu, Wednesday nights at 10, 9 Central on TogiNet.com.
Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host, Steve Jorgensen.
The title of the book, The Adventures of Petey Pots and Pans. My name is not a game. And the author is Dr. Lotfi Bashir. And Dr. Bashir joins us now on Indie Book Publishing. And this interview is brought to you by Lulu. Hello, Doctor.
Hi.
Great to have you with us. You have a couple of very active Chihuahua puppies, and you just had to turn them into a story, didn't you?
Yes, I sure did that.
So this story is a really cute story. What would you say is the overall theme?
It goes about our own dogs. They're two Chihuahua puppies that, you know, you interact with them all day, and just like, you know, they always strive for your attention just like normal children do. So after a while, they become real characters, and you know, from observing them, sometimes we see certain things that goes on in our daily life that eventually it inspired me to write the book about them and just give them that with a little imagination, make them into characters that hopefully will children can relate to and sometimes be able to motivate them and inspire them to do the right thing.
Petey Pots and Pans, now, that name, how does he feel about that?
Well, he doesn't feel too well about it, at least in the beginning, because that's his first name. And, you know, that's the most unusual name. And sometimes in this world, if you come out with a name that is a little unusual, you'll be subject to a lot of teasing. And a lot of, in real life, you'll be sometimes chastised for it, and you'll be left with scars later on in life. So the book addresses this issue and just gives sometimes children a way or some useful tools how to handle this problem as far as teasing with name and sometimes with bullying in general.
Now, before we talk more about some of the other characters and some of the different situations that Petey Pots and Pans gets into, this book filled with really, really captivating photos of your two dogs and other animals.
That is correct. You know, the I just started with taking some pictures of them, and we have also a cat, Newbie the cat, who was also plays a role in this book in trying to, you know, just to give a little bit more depth to the book that will illustrate what goes on in our daily life and embodied with the dogs.
Newbie the cat, as well as, I guess, his fellow Chihuahua buddy, Ducky Bobby.
Yes, Ducky Bobby. Ducky Bobby, he was born in Talladega, Alabama, actually. So he was a little rough upbringing. So he plays also a role in working with Petey Pot and Pence, trying sometimes to help him and sometimes tease him during his daily life.
Now, what happens with Petey Potts and Pans? What happens? Why doesn't he want to go to school?
Well, because of every time he went to school, the kids usually laugh every time the teachers called his name. So, you know, eventually he started having stomach ache and sometimes headaches and refuses to go to school. So, you know, in the beginning, just like most children do, did not say anything. He just tried to handle it on his own. And eventually, it just made him really sick. And then his mother had to interfere and help him out. And Justin Thomas was able to find him some inspiration in the most unusual places.
And Mom was trying to teach him that in spite of maybe some of his challenges, like with his name, he can really become anything he wants to be.
That is correct. That's what the book goes about, trying to give him an inspiration and actually give him a little tool that there is a little bit more than just the name. You know, it's about the character and about the person.
So as you put in your title, My Name Is Not a Game, it's just something that he's learning from. Just his name is maybe really be a blessing to him.
It could have been. You know, sometimes adversity can create character, but sometimes adversity can also destroy people. So it depends on your perspective and how you deal with it and how you handle it. And that's basically what the book tried to do, trying to turn lemon into lemonade, trying to give children ways to think of adversity and bullying in another way rather than just a negative way and just coming home and acting ill or acting sick. And it just, you know, this is this book is like inspired by the Reach Out and Read program. It is like a national program. I don't know if you have heard of it, but it's more a program that started in Massachusetts. Actually started it by an educator and two pediatricians in Boston, Massachusetts in the late 90s. And this book, this program, the Reach Out and Read program, was about giving children free children books at the doctor's offices to encourage literacy to start at a very young age, to teach, you know, to allow the parents to read to their children. You know, for years we have given many children books for free to children when they come for their well checkups at the doctor's office, at our office. And, you know, there was a lot of funding for that program, but eventually the funding ran out or was like drying up, and so was the free books. So I tried, you know, initially we bought some books from different bookstores, and I found out that many of these books is just the stories, unfortunately, has no meaning to it. So I thought, why don't we take this program to the next level? You know, that's true, literacy is great, but why don't we let the children read something with substance, with some messages that would help them through their life and at least learn something from it and give them a way to handle their daily stresses in a positive manner. That's how the book started. I started with the first book. I was published in 2013. The title of that book was "The Facing the Bully," and also it goes over how actually Ducky Bobby was the bully, was bullying Petey Potts and Pans, and again, it's just it gives the children the message that there is more than one way to handle a bully rather than just ignoring it.
And more books to come in the series.
I sure hope so. I found writing these books very rewarding. I received a lot of support and encouragement from the children. You know, just seeing their faces lit up as they leave the office with the book, with the looking at the puppies, it just gave me an encouragement to do more. And that's basically my book's going to be mostly about bullying or name calling or other things that the children can use for daily life, and sometimes other life learning experiences that may help them out, all through Petey Pots and Pans and Ducky Bobby.
The Adventures of Petey Pots and Pans, and we've been listening to the author, Dr. Lotfi Bashir. Doctor, what's the best way to get your books?
You can actually order it on Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com, and also you can order it from Lulu.com, Lulu Publishing. It comes in two versions. It comes in the e-book version, and it comes in the printed version.
It's been great to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And this interview has been brought to you by Lulu.
You've been listening to Indie Book Publishing with your host, Steve Jorgensen. Join us again next week at noon Eastern as Steve interviews another great author.